And Congressional Budget Office has put the price tag as high as $500 billion. I'm Christopher Martinez.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
But I will not dance to your war drum. I will not lend my soul nor my bones to your war drum. I will not dance to that beating. I know that beat. It is lifeless. I know intimately that skin you are hitting. It was alive once, hunted, stolen, stretched. I will not dance to your drummed up war. I will not pop, spin, break for you. I will not hate for you or even hate you. I will not kill for you. Especially, I will not die for you. I will not mourn the dead with murder nor suicide. I will not side with you or dance to bombs because everyone is dancing. Everyone can be wrong. Life is a right, not collateral or casual. I will not forget where I come from. I will craft my own drum. Gather my beloved near and our chanting will be dancing. Our humming will be drumming. I will not be played. I will not lend my name nor my rhythm to your beat. I will dance and resist and dance and persist and dance. This heartbeat is louder than death. Your war drum ain't louder than this breath. What's up, TED people? Let me hear you make some noise. A bunch of pacifists. Confused, aspiring pacifists. I understand. I've been wrong a lot lately. Like, a lot. So I couldn't figure out what to read today. I mean, I've been saying I've been prepping. What that means is prepping my outfit, prepping options, trying to figure out what I'm coming behind and going in front of. Poetry does that. It preps you. It aims you. So I am going to read a poem that was chosen just now, but I'm going to need you to just sit for like 10 minutes and hold a woman who is not here. Hold her now. With you. You don't have to say her name out loud. You can just hold her. Are you holding her? This is Break Clustered. All Holy History Band. Unwritten books predicted the future, projected the past, but my head unwraps around what appears limitless. Man's creative violence. Whose son shall it be? Which male child will perish a new day? Our boys' deaths galvanized, prophets ignored, worn tooth enamel, salted lemon childhoods, all colors run, none of us solid. Don't look for shadow behind me, I carry it within. I live cycles of light and darkness, rhythm is half silence. I see now, I never was one and not the other. Sickness, health, tender violence. I think now I never was pure. Before form, I was storm. Blind, ignorant, still am. Humanity contracted itself. Blind, malignant, I never was pure. Girl spoiled before ripened. Language can't math me. I experience exponentially. Everything is everything. One woman loses 15, maybe 20 members of her family. One woman loses 6. One woman loses her head. One woman searches rubble. One woman feeds on trash. One woman shoots her face. One woman shoots her husband. One woman straps herself. One woman gives birth to a baby. One woman gives birth to borders. One woman no longer believes love will ever find her. One woman never did. Where do refugee hearts go? Broken, dissed, placed where they're not from, don't want to be missed, faced with absence. We mourn each one, or we mean nothing at all. My spine curves spiral, precipice running to and running from human beings, cluster bombs left behind, de facto landmines, a smoldering grief, harvest, contaminated tobacco. Harvest bombs, harvest baby teeth, harvest palms, smoke, harvest witness, smoke, resolutions, smoke, salvation, smoke, redemption, smoke, breathe. Do not fear what has blown up. If you must, fear the unexploded. Thank you.
That was Suhair Hamad reading a couple of her poems about war, about women, about genocide. And believe it or not, that poem, those poems were read 14 years ago at a TED Talk, and they still feel like it's today. So anybody that thinks history started on October 7th should listen to these poems that Suhair Hamad used to read. And that last line is one of the most cautionary lines in poetry. You know, fear not the exploded, fear the unexploded. And that's what we do in dark times. We sing about the dark times, and poetry is the way to do it, and to bring us to catharsis. Because the right now we're in a countdown. Tens of thousands of infants will die within 48 hours, according to the UN, if food is not brought in, and it's been 24 hours, and only 5 trucks have been brought into Gaza, and one of them is actually just has funeral shrouds, and yet that aid hasn't been distributed or delivered. Today's show is going to focus on the fact that finally, after what, 500 and some days of massacre and starvation and rape by Israel, by the IDF, that we finally, Western nations are piping up and saying, we're going to sanction Israel, we're going to do this and that. So today's show is about redemption, and redemption that comes a little bit too late, because we always thought or said that from the very beginning, from October 2023, we said that at some point history is going to judge all these people, all the Netanyahus, all the Smotrich, all the Bidens, all the Trumps of the world. But the problem is that we can't wait for history's judgment, because what's going to happen in the interim is mass massacre. And that's what's happened, this genocide that we're living through right now. And even as we're living through, even as Israel attacks not only Gaza, not only the West Bank, not only Lebanon, but also Syria, and now it's preparing to attack Iran, as all the reports are showing. This country of sociopaths that are attacking the world, shredding everything around them, thinks that it's going to survive this, but it's not. But the problem is not whether Israel is going to survive or not. It's how many people it's going to kill on its way down. And that's what I wanted to share with you. The most important book for me that has come out in the last few years is Omar Aqad's One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. This is a book that was written a few years ago, after October, obviously, of 2023, but is so prophetic. It was actually published at the beginning of this year, and it predicts everything we know right now. This is a book that has been heralded by many people, and I would encourage you to give it as a gift to any student that's graduating today, because this is the historic moment that they're living, and we're seeing the elements of that, and we're seeing his prophetic voice come true. Everything that he prophesied in this book is coming true right now, and that's those are the clips I'll be sharing today. But I wanted to read you what Omar Aqad means by saying one day everyone will have always been against this. And it's even though it's prose, it reads like poetry, and it's so spot on. So I have to share it with you. Omar says, one day there will be an accounting, even as so often those who did the worst things imaginable in the killing fields were allowed to meld back into polite society. The man who put the bullet in the little girl's head might return to coach little league games. The patrol that opened fire on the starving civilians might meet up every now and then for karaoke nights, might celebrate what they did when it's still acceptable, but over the years grow quieter and finally bond over a shared silence thicker than blood. The soldier who drove the tank over the handcuffed body, who heard the sound and felt the rupture, might come home to a high school sweetheart and get down on one knee, and might have children of his own one day. People who proved themselves capable of the most monstrous things human beings can do to one another might be granted one final immunity, because what's the alternative? To look into a neighbor's eyes and see barely visible the kind of stain no amount of repentance will ever wash away? Who can live like that? Better to move on. There will be people who never move on, who to the end of their lives struggle to unsee the image of the body turned to red paste, the child forced to eat animal feed, the bones pushing against skin, the slow extinguishing of life at the hands of hunger, the older siblings who must tell the younger ones that everyone else is gone, the hastily dug graves vast against the horizon like goosebumps on the flesh of the earth. And every time they hear a politician profess the supremacy of international law, of human rights, of equality for all, they will hear only the sounds of screaming. And yet, against all this, one day things will change. Along the ledger of atrocity, I keep another, the Palestinian doctor who would not abandon his patients even as the bombs closed in. The Icelandic writer who raised money to get the displaced out of Gaza. The American doctors and nurses who risked their lives to go treat the wounded in the middle of the killing field. The puppet maker who, injured and driven from his home, kept making dolls
to entertain the children. The congresswoman who stood her ground in the face of censure, of constant vitriol, of her own colleagues' indifference. The protesters, the ones who gave up their privilege, their jobs, who risked something to speak out. The people who filmed and photographed and documented all this, even as it happened to them, even as they buried their dead. It's not hard to believe, even during the worst things, that courage is the more potent contagion, that there are more invested in solidarity than annihilation, that just as it always have been possible to look away, it's always possible to stop looking away. None of this evil was ever necessary. Some carriages are gilded and others lacquered in blood, but the same engine pulls us all. We dismantle it now, build another thing entirely, or we hurtle toward the cliff, safe in the certainty that when the time comes, we'll learn to lay tracks on air. And that's how Omar al-Akkad concludes his book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. And that's what our next clip is about, is these Western nations who have supplied the weapons for the slaughter, who have supplied the intelligence for the slaughter, who have supported the state of Israel morally in this genocide, are finally showing some repentance and threats, empty threats at that, but nonetheless, the tide is turning. But it doesn't seem to be affecting this threat that has run down to 24 hours now, where starving children will die in Gaza because these hundreds of trucks that are waiting to feed them are being held back by the state of Israel, by the United States, by the UK, and by the European Union. And that's the reality of it. So with that, let's have a listen to Glenn Greenwald talk about how these Western nations are now turning against Netanyahu.
Now, the only reason the Israeli government is saying, all right, we'll finally allow some food in, just give them a little food, not all of them, just like little crumbs to get in, is because they watch the world, the part of the world that has always been most fanatically and unconditionally pro-Israel, finally say, I can't associate myself with this any longer. I have to speak out against it. It's starting to reach one of those levels of criminality and atrocity and just inhumane genocide that people are starting to realize, like, what is going to be of my life if the true extent of what has happened comes out? And I was one of those people who encouraged it and supported it. And then even as the true extent of the criminality emerged, I never said anything. I was too cowardly. This is what's going on in a lot of people's brains, including people who have long supported Israel and specifically the war in Gaza. One of the most pro-Israel journals in the West has long been The Economist. They have vocally and vehemently supported the Israeli destruction of Gaza. And yet on May 8th, just last week, they published an article entitled "The War in Gaza Must End. America Should Press Benjamin Netanyahu to Accept a Ceasefire, Then Press Hamas to Disarm." And here's what they said, quote, "This time, Israeli officials insist things will be different. On May 5th, the cabinet approved a new plan for Gaza. There is no reason to believe that they are right. For a start, the operation is unlikely to free the hostages who remain imprisoned in Gaza. The only people who benefit from continuing the war are Mr. Netanyahu, who keeps his coalition intact, and his far-right allies, who dream of emptying Gaza and rebuilding Jewish settlements there. Food should not be used as a weapon. Israel must allow aid into Gaza and let charities distribute it. Some will be stolen by Hamas, which cares little for the plight of Gazans. That is bad, but the alternative would be starvation. One of the few newspapers equal to The Economist in terms of just being longtime spokespeople for the establishment, longtime supporters of Israel, is the Financial Times. And right around the same time, May 6th, they published an editorial with this title, "The West's Shameful Silence on Gaza. The U.S. and Europeans should do more to restrain Benjamin Netanyahu," and basically went through the criminality of the war, how it went so much further than anybody anticipated, which is ridiculous. The one thing I will give the Israelis credit for is that they never hid their true intentions. I mean, they gave the idiots in the West who just blindly defend them some scripts to read about the hostages, Hamas or whatever, but they were, even before October 7th, they were extremely clear. They want the West Bank and Gaza as their own. They wanted all Palestinians gone. They believe God gave them that land. And not only are they taking land in Lebanon and in Syria, lots of it, for themselves, all using U.S. weapons and U.S. money, they're now bombing the West Bank, clearing out the West Bank, forcing people out of their homes, letting these maniacal settlers, many of which come from the United States, not just under the nose of the IDF, but with the affirmative protection of the IDF, driving Palestinians out of their homes and taking them for themselves. But that was the plan in Gaza all along. Probably the most pro-Israel pundit in all of the United States, and probably the most influential when it comes to liberal American Jews' views of Israel, is Tom Friedman. He loves Israel. He constantly has been in Israel. He used to be a reporter in Jerusalem. He is a very vocal and passionate Zionist. And yet on May 9th, he published an op-ed in the New York Times with this headline, quote, "This Israeli government is not our ally." Quote, "The notion that Israel has a government that is no longer behaving as an American ally and should not be considered as such is a shocking and bitter pill for Israel's friends in Washington to swallow. But swallow it they must. I have zero sympathy for Hamas. I think it is a sick organization that has done tremendous enormous damage to the Palestinian cause. It is hugely responsible for the human tragedy that is Gaza today. Hamas's leadership should have released its hostages and left Gaza a long time ago, removing any excuse for Israel to resume the fighting." That just gives you a sense for how dedicated he still is to the script of whose fault this is. But he nonetheless says, "But Netanyahu's plan to reinvade Gaza is not to stand up a moderate alternative to Hamas led by the Palestinian Authority. It is for a permanent Israeli military occupation whose unstated goal will be to pressure all Palestinians to leave. This is a prescription for a permanent insurgency, a Vietnam on the Mediterranean." And the reason he's saying that the government who's doing that can't be considered a U.S. ally is because it, for decades, has been the U.S. position that is extremely damaging to American interests for this Palestinian-Israeli conflict to go unresolved without a two-state solution, because it impedes America's ability to do business in the Middle East. It causes anti-American hatred, because everyone knows that the only reason Israel gets away with all of this is because the United States, the most powerful military in the world in history, the biggest economy in the world, just forces American taxpayers to pay for it all and even deploys military assets, put service members in the United States in harm's way to always defend Israel, no matter how many wars it starts. And so even Tom Friedman is saying, if they're going to reinvade Gaza and take it over, as they're clearly wanting to do, or annex the West Bank, the level of hatred, not just toward Israel, but the United States and the Middle East, will be out of control. Another very vocal supporter of Israel, Piers Morgan, on May 16th, posted the following, quote, "Another day, another horrific massacre in Gaza. This cannot go on. Netanyahu is out of control and must be stopped." Now, a lot of this is just conscience clearing. I watched this happen during the Iraq War. At the beginning, all the people who were opposed to the Iraq War were treated as like dirty leftists and communists and America haters and pro-terrorists. And then once the decent, respected establishment realized that they were right and that they had to admit it, they kind of came in with this posture like, the real voices that matter are here now to say that this war is wrong. And even though, yeah, these people over here have been saying it from the start, they don't count. They weren't saying it for the right reasons. We are the authoritative voices, and when we say it's wrong, that's when it's wrong. And that's exactly what they're doing now. They're pretending like there's something about this war that was unpredictable, that it went to too many dark places. It was so obvious it was going to go here from the start. Here's an Israeli citizen who is a self-described passionate Zionist, believes strongly in the state of Israel, Shayel Ben Ephraim. He's a fairly prominent commentator in Israel. And he said this on May 1st, quote, "It gives me no pleasure to do this, but it has to be done. I have thought long and hard about it, and Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Here's my full explanation of why and how I reached that conclusion." And he goes on to explain that he used to vehemently object to the use of genocide for what Israel was doing. He used to get angry about it. And now he realizes that's the only term for it. Outside of the United States, probably the two most dedicated and devoted supporters of Israel are the UK and Germany. Germany because they're still trying to repent for the guilt they feel, absolve themselves of the guilt they feel from World War II and the Holocaust. And ironically, I guess they think that giving weapons and money to the Israelis to help them ethnically cleanse and commit genocide against the Palestinians is a way to repent for their sins from 65 years ago. But the UK is even more devoted to Israel. And yet, members of parliament from the Conservative Party, the Tories, are starting to stand up and say, "I've supported Israel my whole life. I supported this war. But I have to say, I apologize for that I was wrong. And I see that I'm wrong now." Here's Edward Lee, very standard conservative, a Tory member of the House of Commons. And here's what he said on May 14th.
"I've been a member of the Conservative Friends of Israel for over 40 years, longer than anybody here. And Hamas is a brutal terrorist organization that hides people, their own fighters, under hospitals. But it's frankly unacceptable to recklessly bomb a hospital. It's unacceptable to starve a whole people. Is the minister aware that many Friends of Israel worldwide, notwithstanding narrow legal definitions, are asking this moral question: when is genocide not genocide?"
And Mr. Speaker, I have had in recent weeks a series of very powerful interventions from the benches opposite, and I take them seriously with the weight that they hold, particularly from the father of the house and my neighbour in Lincolnshire. We will not move towards making determinations from dispatch boxes on questions of legal determination. But that does not mean we will wait, Mr. Speaker. The preliminary judgments of the ICJ and the provisional measures that they set out are important, and we will abide by them.
So interestingly, you have the conservative members of the parliament, including this guy who for 40 years has been in the Friends of Israel group. I don't know why these people get elected to represent the British people and then immediately go and join the Friends of Israel caucus, but whatever. That's just part of what conservatives and members of Labour have long done in the UK, just like the United States. If you're elected to Congress, it means you have to go make pilgrimage to Israel. You have to hold press conferences on it every day. You have to post about it every day. You have to introduce pro-Israel resolutions every day. But even he's saying, look, I just, you know, this is too much. And that he wasn't the only one. Here from The Independent on March 4th, MPs report witnessing armed intimidation by Israeli settlers in the West Bank. Senator Edward Lee and Uma Kumaran were among those to recount their experiences. And there was a separate MP who stood up and actually apologized for his support for Israel in this war, saying, "I was totally wrong." Earlier today, there was a joint statement from three countries long vocally pro-Israel, United Kingdom, France, and Canada. They issued a joint statement on the situation in Gaza and the West Bank, and this is what they said, quote, "We strongly oppose the expansion of Israel's military. We strongly oppose the expansion of Israel's military operation in Gaza. The level of human suffering in Gaza is intolerable. Yesterday's announcement that Israel will allow a basic quantity of food into Gaza is wholly inadequate. We call on the Israeli government to stop its military operation in Gaza and immediately allow humanitarian aid to enter. This must include engaging with the UN to ensure a return to delivery of aid in line with humanitarian principles. The Israeli government's denial of essential humanitarian assistance to the civilian population is unacceptable and risks breaching international humanitarian law. Oh no, it risks breaching? It hasn't already breached that? We condemn the abhorrent language used recently by members of the Israeli government, threatening that in their despair at the destruction of Gaza, civilians will start to relocate. Permanent forced displacement is a breach of international humanitarian law. We will not stand by while the Netanyahu government pursues these egregious actions. If Israel does not cease the renewed military offensive and lifts its restrictions on humanitarian aid, we will take further concrete actions in response. Oh, that must be so scary for Netanyahu. I bet he's traumatized that Canada and France and the UK are saying, if you don't stop, we're going to take real concrete actions. These countries are arming Israel. They paid for a big part of the war. They diplomatically support Israel. And now they finally got around to like, oh, we better issue a statement condemning it so we have clean consciences so that when we die, no one can say that we didn't speak up. They go on, quote, we oppose any attempt to expand settlements in the West Bank. Israel must halt settlements which are illegal and undermine the validity of a Palestinian state and the security of both Israelis and Palestinians. We will not hesitate to take further actions, including targeting sanctions. This is just ass covering by people who are increasingly realizing what they applauded, what they enabled. It's like people who joined the Nazi Party in 1938, 1939, 1940, 1941. And then by 1944, they're like, you know what? I think we've gone too far. I'm going to renounce my membership in the Nazi Party. Or like the people who supported the war in Iraq. And then like 8 years later, were like, maybe this is a mistake. Or like the people who supported the war in Vietnam. And then, you know, 2 million Vietnamese later and 60,000 American troops later lost their lives, and they said, I don't know, it's starting to seem like this is probably going too far. I'm going to start to speak out about this 10 years into the war. Here is Germany, which, as I said, outside the United States, is one of the two countries, along with Great Britain, who has most vehemently supported Israel. This is from their foreign office. And they've had, from the start of the war in Israel, they've armed Israel, they've sent money to Israel. They sent all their top officials to Israel to stress their solidarity with the Israelis when it comes to Gaza. And yet now they're saying this, quote, joint donor statement to humanitarian aid to Gaza. Whilst we acknowledge an indications of a limited restart of aid, Israel blocked humanitarian aid entering Gaza for over 2 months. Food, medicines, and essential supplies are exhausted. The population faces starvation. Gaza's people must receive the aid they desperately need. As humanitarian donors, we have two straightforward messages for the government of Israel. Allow a full resumption of aid into Gaza immediately and enable the UN and humanitarian organizations to work independently and impartially to save lives, reduce suffering, and maintain dignity. We remain committed to meeting this acute need we see in Gaza. Now, it does seem like the Israeli government's effort to pretend to allow in humanitarian aid is not effective to allow these countries to pretend they're doing that, in part because barely any aid got in today. And barely any aid is going to get in. Everybody knows that. But more so because the Israeli government said, we're not really going to let in much aid. We just need to do this to give the governments around the world an excuse to allow us to get on with our ultimate solution to the Gaza problem, which is cleanse it all. Turn it into a parking lot, cleanse it all, put the remaining Palestinians in camps, and then rebuild apartments and houses and resorts only for Jews and make Gaza part of Israel. And they put these governments in a difficult position because their populations are starting to turn on them. People just don't want to see this anymore. They can't take it. Polls in the United States have showed a significant collapse in support for Israel among all demographic groups, including young Republicans, the only exception being older Republicans who watch Fox News, that demographic. But the Israelis are like an apocalyptic cult. They don't care what, they don't recognize moral limits. They don't acknowledge the humanity of Palestinians. They absolutely consider Palestinians to be animals. There's no way you can just do what they've done to Gaza. Bomb every remaining hospital and mosque and school. They're bombing electricity generators for hospitals so that ICU patients on incubators die. They bomb shelters. They've constantly bombed people in tents. The number of children who are dead, including under 3 years old, is just as a statistic as shocking in itself. And there's no question the number of people who have died that we hear from Gaza is extremely underestimated because they only count the people who go through the morgue. Huge numbers of people are still lying under that rubble. There's massive rubble everywhere with bodies underneath who don't make it to the morgue. There are other people who die of disease or hunger who aren't counted because they're not actually killed with bombs or bullets, but they're victims of the Israeli action nonetheless. They've stripped the Palestinians in Gaza of all remaining humanity. I mean, they go to bed every night with Israeli bombers over their head, being terrorized every night that that's the last night their children are going to wake up. I don't even know how you get through this and then maintain any semblance of life, especially the million children in Gaza whose childhood is shaped by this. How do you function? How do you become a normal human being? How do you ever feel safe or stable? Or it's inconceivable. And as I said, I mean, if I think even if we weren't directly involved in it, you would have a need to speak up about it just because the levels of atrocity are so severe. Millions being starved to death and indiscriminately slaughtered every night. Just in terms of what your concern is about American interests, especially people who have called themselves America first. This war is devastating for the United States as well. It's expensive. If it leads to war with Iran, as we're about to talk about, it could be even more devastating in multiple ways if we let Israel drag us into this war. But even just this in and of itself, you know, I know there are people who say, like, hey, you talk about Israel too much, you cover Israel too much. I understand that. We do cover it a lot. I should remind you, though, that when the war in Ukraine was raging, we covered the war in Ukraine just as much because that, too, was an American war. And we talked about all the same things. But obviously, I mean, the number of civilians killed in Ukraine is a tiny, infinitesimal fraction of the number of people who have killed in the civilians who have been killed in Gaza, despite the fact that Ukraine is a more populous country by a significant margin than Gaza. Just in raw numbers, the amount of civilians in Gaza are way, way more. Even though that war has only lasted, that attack has only lasted 16 months, whereas the one in Ukraine has gone on for, it's in its fourth full year. How can you not talk about this frequently? I mean, there's nothing else like it. And it's a U.S. government policy. And there are events, and we feel compelled to report on them. And also, I think it's important to make manifest exactly what is happening so that Americans can decide for themselves if this is something they want to continue to support. Thanks for watching.
So that was Glenn Greenwald reporting on how Israel's supporters are turning against Netanyahu. Obviously, Netanyahu doesn't really care because he has this solid coalition, this very extremist coalition that doesn't really care about anything. And as long as he has that coalition together, he doesn't have to listen to his allies. And if past history shows us anything, just like they... when they acted under Biden, who was pretending that he is trying to pressure them into a ceasefire and to stop the starvation of the population and the killing of children. The reality was that was all just lip service. There was no action behind it. Continuing along the theme of countries turning against Israel, our next segment really talks about how Israel has already lost the Gaza war. It just doesn't know it. And this is not triumphalism that we're talking about in this next segment, but we're talking about this in the context of previous wars, what we've learned from previous wars. And I would encourage everybody to watch the Netflix documentary right now that is on. It's called Turning Point, the War in Vietnam, or the Vietnam War. It's a pretty incredible expose on what really, of course, we've heard of all the failures, but I've never seen anything so compelling about the failure of that war and how we're repeating those mistakes right now, and how the people that were leading us into war didn't really know anything about the region that they're attacking and bombing, and how there were puppeteers behind the president and the president was merely a puppet. Let's have a listen to Middle East Eye report on Israel has already lost the Gaza war.
Episode of the TV game show The White House on Uber, how to pre-purchase an American president, it appeared fleetingly as if the host was reading from the right script. Donald Trump said in Saudi Arabia that liberal interventionism was a disaster. True. He said you can't make or break nations. Post-Soviet Russia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Yemen are each testimony to that. He stopped bombing Yemen and reversed decades of sanctions on Syria, blocking in the process two of Israel's main routes to regional dominance, a divided Syria and a weakened Iran. I say fleetingly because what a US president promises and what he delivers are actually two different things. Iran knows all about that when it thought sanctions were going to be lifted in exchange for curtailing its nuclear enrichment program. Not least of those to be blindsided by Trump's announcement halting Syria sanctions were his own officials in the US Treasury. Unpicking the piles of sanctions that have been layered on Syria since it was first put on a list of countries which sponsor terrorism will not be rapid or comprehensive. However, this particular episode of the show cost its sponsors, Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Qatar, more than $3 trillion and counting, which is high even by the lavish standards of the Gulf. There was $6 billion from Saudi Arabia, $1.2 trillion worth of deals with Qatar, a personal 747 for use as president, a tower for Trump's son Eric, and an AI center in Dubai, and much, much more to come, including cryptocurrency deals with the Trump family firm World Liberty Financial. The richest Arabs were competing with each other to lay tribute at the feet of Washington's latest emperor. While this orgiastic display of wealth was taking place in Riyadh and Doha, Israel was marking the anniversary of the 1948 Nakba by killing as many Palestinians as it could in Gaza and the West Bank. Nearly 100 people were killed on the day in which Trump was in Riyadh. Bunker-busting bombs were dropped near the European hospital at Khan Yunis, a strike aimed at Mohammed Sinwar, the de facto leader of Hamas in Gaza. Like the assassination of the late Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, Israel was targeting a key negotiator at a time when it was purporting to negotiate. If indeed Sinwar is dead, it will take time to re-establish secure communication within Hamas, with one of several men who could now step into his shoes. His attempted or actual killing is proof, if any more is needed, that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had no intention of bringing the remaining hostages home alive. A hostage deal needs Hamas's forces to retain command and control. A guerrilla fight needs none. Netanyahu's mission in Gaza, which is to starve and bomb as many of the 2.1 million Palestinians out of the enclave as he can, as the famine caused by a two-month total blockade of food, water, and electricity has deepened. Not even the international community can ignore it. Not a day passes without a call from the UN that genocide is indeed taking place, and some European leaders have reacted. French President Emmanuel Macron called the Israeli policy in Gaza shameful. The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, called Israel a genocidal state while speaking in Parliament and noting that Madrid does not do business with such a country. But not one public word of condemnation about Israel's behavior in Gaza was spoken to Trump from the lips of Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince and de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, nor from the UAE President Mohammed bin Zayed, or the Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. The charade in the Gulf was a massive betrayal for Palestinians. But as Palestinians know only too well, Arab rulers have a track record of abandoning them. Hamas and Hezbollah have both been severely weakened, although I question whether the blows they have received are terminal. But Hamas is still fighting on the ground as the underreported Israeli military death toll in Gaza continues to show. And no single guard has given up their hostage to save their own lives. The spirit of resistance in Gaza has not been defeated. In fact, the parallels with another historic defeat of colonial forces, the French and the Americans, have only grown stronger. In one sense, there is no comparison between Gaza and the Vietnam War. The force Israel uses today in Gaza dwarfs that used by John F. Kennedy, Lyndon B. Johnson, and Richard Nixon, the three US presidents whose terms were stained by Vietnam. In a span of 8 years, the US dropped more than 5 million tons of bombs on Vietnam, making it the most bombed place on Earth. But by January of this year, Israel had dropped at least 100,000 tons of bombs on Gaza. Put another way, the US dropped around 15 tons of explosive per square kilometer of Vietnam, while Israel has dropped 275 tons per square kilometer of Gaza, a figure that is higher by a factor of 18. That being said, the current generation of war watchers can only experience a crushing sense of déjà vu when they watch the painstakingly complete account of the conflict in a new mini-series, Turning Point, the Vietnam War. The since acknowledged futility of the US military campaign against the Viet Cong is mirrored and amplified by Israel's military attempts to wipe Hamas off the face of the map. As the US involvement in the Vietnam War expanded and Washington had to drop the pretense that more than 16,000 troops and pilots were advising the South Vietnamese army, it became clear to both Washington and Saigon that they were going to have to push the Viet Cong out of the countryside and regain government control of around 12,000 hamlets. Probably nothing turned the Vietnamese villagers in South Vietnam against the US and their own government in Saigon faster than something called the Strategic Hamlet Program. These were the fortified settlements where villagers who had been turned out of their ancestral lands by the US troops could be forced to resettle. In the jargon of the newsreel at the time, the villagers could start a new life purged of the communists. Closely allied to this was another assumption of the US pacification program, the father of today's counterinsurgency. This was born out of the problems US soldiers had in distinguishing civilians from combatants. The solution lay in treating any Vietnamese encountered in a declared fire-free zone as the enemy and opening fire without referring up the chain of command. The US troops were told that as all Vietnamese were free to leave, it followed, as night follows day, that all the Vietnamese that stayed were part of the infrastructure of the Viet Cong. The villagers starved in their Viet Cong free encampments because they lost access to their paddy fields. The main aim, however, was not to feed them, but to clear the countryside. The result was that the villagers fled their encampments and the Viet Cong came ever closer to the cities. Now, there are two other similarities between today and 1968. The protests and the vicious levels of repression on US campuses, and the extent to which the American and Israeli militaries felt they had to dehumanize their enemy before committing atrocities. After the 1968 My Lai massacre, in which around 500 unarmed and innocent civilians were killed in the span of just a few hours, the American commander, General William Westmoreland, said that life is cheap to the Vietnamese. He said, "The Oriental doesn't put the same high price on life as the Westerner." Israeli leaders go much further than Westmoreland did. They call Palestinians human animals. Indeed, all this history from decades ago sounds eerily pertinent to the present day in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. From the general's plan to starve over a million Palestinians out of North Gaza to today's current military operation called Gideon's Chariots, the tactic of terrorizing and starving the Palestinians into the boats and the sea is the same. Israel's admission that it will let in a bare minimum of food simply seals the legal case against it in the International Court of Justice. What Vietnam did for LBJ and Nixon, Gaza will do for Netanyahu and his successor as Prime Minister, probably Naftali Bennett. For Netanyahu is much more ill from cancer than he is publicly acknowledged to be, according to sources in Britain who see him regularly. Two factors ended the Vietnam War, and with it more than a century of struggle to rid a country of a colonial master: the determination of the Vietnamese and public opinion in America. The same two factors will lead the Palestinian people to their own state: the determination of Palestinians to stay or die on their land, and public opinion in the West, which is already rapidly turning against Israel. Watch it carefully. It is seeping into even right-wing circles and is firmly established on the left. Labeling legitimate criticism of the genocide that is taking place as anti-Semitic won't work anymore. That bolt has already been fired. It is both in Palestine and in the hearts and minds of the West, from which the Zionist project grew and flourished, and on which it is so dependent, that this war is being fought. Israel may win each battle, as the Americans did in Vietnam, but it will lose the war.
That was Middle East Eye report on how Israel has already lost the Gaza war. It just doesn't know it. And it ties well with the present documentary on Netflix about the Vietnam War, titled Turning Point, the Vietnam War, that I would highly recommend that you watch, and to see that no lessons were learned by anybody from that. And we'll end with here I have a recording, a recital of a poem that I read the other day at the 48th anniversary of WPFW, our radio station. This poem is titled, "I Translate the Name of Boys Killed in Gaza." I translate the names of boys killed in Gaza, by Renoir Jauhari. In the city of poets, there's a boy with a stone. He is the guardian. Lion-hearted and small, the stone half of his palm half of mine, the land scorched by naked sun. The blue of the sky lightens his eyes. In the city of poets, there's a boy with a stone. We call him Haidar, which means lion, which means brave. We call him Khadr, which means goodness. We call him Ahmad, which means commendable. We call him Rashad, which means good judgment. In the city of poets, the boy with the stone can visit his family in Al-Quds, which means Jerusalem. He picks oranges and lemons with his grandfather on an orchard, as long as his small boy body can see. He fills a basket with a vibrant fruit for his mother. He doesn't drop the stone. We call him Riyadh, which means gardens. We call him Siraj, which means light. We call him Mazen, which means cloud. We call him Saad, which means happiness. We call him Basim, which means the one who smiles. He is always smiling. On his shoulders,
He holds his sister up to a branch. She can't reach, and they both fall, laughing to the soft red earth that's known them and fed them in every past life. He leads her back home, where their mother bakes bread. He holds her hand. He doesn't drop the stone. We call him Mehdi, which means rightly guided. We call him Amir, which means prince. We call him Al'a, which means nobility. We call him Sulayman, which means man of peace. We call him Mustafa, which means chosen one. In the city of poets, there's a boy with a stone. At school, he memorizes verses from Darwish, Samih al-Qasim, Fadwa to Khan. Midway, outside, the sun overhead warms his small body as he kicks a ball to other small boys like him. In each of their hands, there's a stone. We call him Hani, which means carefree and happy. We call him Tariq, which means morning star. We call him Salah, which means peace. We call him Baha, which means brilliance.
4 WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. House Republicans are still trying to push President Trump's massive tax and immigration package across the finish line and tee up a vote that would send Trump's sprawling agenda to the Senate. The House Rules Committee worked through the night on the legislation, but the GOP's narrow majority is far from unified around the proposal. The bill would extend tax cuts that Trump signed into law in 2017 and would spend hundreds of billions of dollars on the Trump administration's mass deportation campaign and funding for defense priorities, including a so-called Golden Dome Continental Missile Defense System. Hardline conservatives said yesterday that the legislation did not sufficiently cut spending and are pushing for deeper cuts, including reductions to Medicaid and other federal benefits programs. In other news, hospitals in Gaza say Israeli strikes overnight and into today have killed at least 82 people, including several women and a week-old infant. On top of Israel's escalation of its military campaign in Gaza, the threat of famine is not letting up. According to a report from the United Nations earlier this month, Israel's blockade of aid since March 2nd has left 1 in 5 people in Gaza, or about 500,000 people, facing starvation. Israel agreed this week to allow a minimal amount of aid into the Palestinian territory. Almost 100 trucks carrying humanitarian aid entered Gaza yesterday, but the UN says Israel's new security processes are preventing it from actually reaching Palestinians who are in desperate need. Even if the aid could be distributed, aid group Doctors Without Borders said in a statement today that the amount of aid that Israel was now allowing into Gaza is ridiculously inadequate, and called Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's efforts a, quote, smokescreen to pretend the siege is over, close quote. In related news, George Washington University this week banned a newly graduated student from speaking out over the institution's ties to Israel. WPFW's Noah Portner has that story.
George Washington University graduate Cecilia Culver entered the spotlight over the weekend when she gave a 3-minute speech denouncing the occupation of Palestine at her graduation. She opened the speech by labeling Israeli actions as genocide, saying,
"I cannot celebrate my own graduation without a heavy heart, knowing how many students in Palestine have been forced to stop their studies expelled from their homes and killed for simply remaining in the country of their ancestors.
She then proceeded to criticize her university's continued investment in defense corporations and other companies tied to the war, even going so far as to ask her fellow graduates to withhold donations. Culver's speech was greeted by rapturous applause, but booing was also mixed in as well. Over 700 affiliates of GW have signed a letter calling for her diploma to be rescinded, and as of Wednesday morning, Culver has been banned from GW's campus. In other news, Congressman Jerry Connolly of Virginia died of esophageal cancer today. Connolly was diagnosed in November and stepped down from his position as the ranking Democrat of the House Oversight Committee in April. While on this powerful committee, Connolly pushed back against the president's firing of federal workers,